All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
Hello, fans of FitzDog Radio. I hope you're doing well. First of all, apologies about this past week's Sunday papers. There was a production gaffe, and the team in St. Louis uploaded the last FitzDog Radio to the Sun. It's since been corrected, but my apologies. A lot of you reached out. We're very concerned that we'd been hijacked or hacked or jacked or hacked. You know, but we're fine. Everything's good. We're back. It's an exciting week here in Hollywood. I've been running around. I opened for Louis C.K. this past week. I don't know if I talked to you about that last week. Jesus Christ, his new hour is so fucking funny. I wish I could quote from it, but I don't want to spoil his hour when you go see it. But that was great. St. Patrick's Day show. I'm sure we talked about that. Did we? I'm sure we did. I'm a little lost on where we are at this point in the world. I've been on the road too much. I'm going on the road again this week. I'm going to fucking Canada, but I don't know if they're anti-America right now. I don't know who's going to show up. Hamilton, Ontario, March 26th. Toronto at the Comedy Bar, March 27th. And then Pittsburgh this weekend. But anyway, I don't know. I got nothing against you Canadians. I fucking love you guys. I'm sorry that our president is a little out of control right now. We don't want to take you on as another state. Actually, we'd like to give you a couple of states. Might I suggest Mississippi? Would you like a little Mississippi? I know it's very far from you, but we kind of like our northern states. That's how we feel about you. North Dakota, good people. Minnesota, love them. Maine, some of the best people. We can't spare them. But Louisiana's all yours. Can I say Texas, or am I losing a lot of audience? I don't know who listens to this show, but let's just say we don't want Canada. We enjoy you, but we can't afford you. Anyway, am I helping or hurting myself? I also did a show. This was so funny. I did a show two nights ago at the Laugh Factory. Packed out house. Crowd was hot. I had a really fun set. And then I get off stage and Paula Abdul walks by. And I'm standing backstage and she looks at me and she gives me a big smile. And she goes, that was amazing. And I was like, thank you. And then she went into the shitter. I don't know if she shat. I'm hoping she didn't at a comedy club. That would be vulgar. Who goes to a comedy club and takes a shit? So I don't think she did. But anyway, I didn't say anything about the fact that we had once spent an entire day together. And I'm sure it was literally 20... I would say it was 30 years ago. I was about 28 years old. I was a sparkling young comic, handsome, good head of hair, white teeth, cocky. And I was hired to do this private event. It was at FAO Schwartz. They emptied out one of the floors of FAO Schwartz. They were launching this new line of watches. Do you remember Swatches? If you're a little older, you'll remember there was a very simple watch called a Swatch that got hot for about 5 years. Anyway, they were launching a new one, and they hired me to do a presentation, to MC a presentation. And Max, this is the craziest lineup, Max Weinberg went up, and Paula Abdul went up. And me and Paula, it was literally like a six-hour thing. And she and I had a lot of downtime, and we were flirty. We had a very nice time. And she's I think she's a little bit older than me. But either way, We flirted, and I had just met my girlfriend, who is now my wife. And it was bad timing. If I had met Paula at another time, I probably would have flirted more. And I get a phone call from the producer of the event asking me if he can give Paula my number. She asked for my number. And I said, I'm flattered, but I'm kind of taken right now. I'm off the market. And thank God I did. I mean, think about it. Who knows if she's crazy? I would imagine she's in show business. She would probably, it probably wouldn't have lasted. So that was that. And then cut to 30 years later, she's smiling at me. And then I go to my Instagram the next day and it said, Paula Abdul is following you. She just started following me. And I'm like, what? So I followed her back. I don't know. Is that wrong? You tell my wife that me and Paula Abdul are following each other, and watch her fucking yawn. Watch her not give two fucks, because it's over between she and I. We had our day, literally our day. And that's it. But I thought that was kind of funny. I thought that was a funny story. It was a show with a guy named Bassam Youssef, I think is how you say it. He's an Egyptian comic, and he's huge. He was like, I remember him from the news because during the Arab Spring, he was very vocal, and he became a big hotshot. I think he was a surgeon, then he went into stand-up comedy, and he had his own TV show. And anyway, like, I'm watching him on stage, and I'm like, wow, I can't believe I've never seen this comic before. And so I look up his name, and it's like, yeah, he's got 12 million followers on Twitter. And he was funny, you know, satirist, political satirist, which is dull. Nobody wants to watch that. It's just too limiting. You're just so limited in what you can talk about and how far you can go with your premises so you don't lose your satirical audience, you know? And his Wikipedia said that he was the John Stewart of the Middle East, and I thought, well, that's great, but which John Stewart? Like, my friend is like, you know, I like the old John Stewart, and I'm like, what does that mean? Does that mean you like the John Stewart from the 90s, from MTV days? Or does that mean you like old John Stewart? Like the old John Stewart or old John Stewart? Like, you never hear people say that, like, I like the old Rolling Stones. Well, you mean the guys that are old? Because I'll agree, they're still great. But I don't know which ones you mean. Anyway, I like my old wife. What do I mean by that? I like my old version of my wife, and I also like, now that she's old, she's great. My wife gets better with age because this, you just don't sweat it. When you're young, you fight battles because you think there's going to be progress. And then you hit a certain amount of years and you just go like, oh no, this is what my wife is. And this is what my husband is. And you just embrace it. It reminds me of It's a Wonderful Life. Remember George Bailey as, he's running down the stairs of his house and he grabs the handle at the bottom of the banister of the stairs, and the handle of the, there's like a little thing and it falls off and he gets frustrated. Oh, this fucking handle at the bottom of my stairs of my new house is broken. And at the end of the movie, when he's embracing his life as it is and appreciating it, it comes off in his hand and he smiles and he puts it back happily. And that's what old marriage is. You go, yeah, the handle's a little loose, but I know that. I'm not trying to fix that handle anymore. My guest today is a woman that I've gotten to know just really over the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 years. It turns out she's been a fan of the podcast, the Sunday Papers, and she listens every week, which I'm flattered by because she's a very smart, accomplished, funny woman. We'll get into her in a moment. But her book, she wrote a book called How to Write a Funny Speech. And I was thinking about speeches that I've written that have been funny over the years. I'm very good at speeches, like even better than I am at stand-up comedy, I think, because I'm not intimidated. I'm not scared of a new weird situation. It kind of brings out the best in me. And I remember I was like maybe 10 years old, maybe 11. And I already loved comedy. I loved comic books. I loved old, like Bill Cosby. I like the old Bill Cosby, huh? Which one am I talking about? I like the pervy Bill Cosby. Anyway, so there was an award show. I was on the swim team, and I was a horrible swimmer. I just didn't float, and I came in last place. But it was one of those things where everybody gets a trophy. So like so they're calling out everybody's name, and they go up and they get their trophy and they shake Mr. D. Mr. D was the swim coach, and he'd shake your hand and all the parents would clap, and then you'd sit down at your table again and finish your chicken. So they call me up and for like last place in breaststroke, because breaststroke is the closest stroke to drowning. And so that's what I basically did. Just slapped at the water and kicked like in a frightened way. And so I get the trophy and I take the mic out of Mr. D's hand and I start thanking everybody. I remember I thanked Jimmy Carter. So yeah, I must have been 10. Jimmy Carter was elected when I was 10. I thanked Jimmy Carter and then I put a peanut in my nose. And then I started thanking everybody that made this possible. I did like a very funny, long, stupid speech for a 10-year-old and I fucking crushed. And I was off, and that was like my first time doing stand-up. And I've always, like, friends' birthday parties, I always jump up. You know, I'll make a few notes. I'll prepare. I don't over-prepare, but I have some thoughts. And I got up at my friend Mary's 50th birthday, and her whole family was there and about 50 friends at a restaurant. And I got up, and I told a story about how I was out to lunch with her in New York, and we came home one day, and it was middle afternoon, it was like 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and we walked into her apartment, and her boyfriend was on the couch, passed out drunk. He was a day drunk, and he used to bartend at an airport, and he was day drunk, and he was passed out on the couch with his pants around his ankles and tissues on his stomach. And I said, and my friend Mary started hitting him and screaming, "You don't fuck me!" And then you jerk off in the middle of it. So I'm telling this crazy story. I tell stories that embarrass people, but it kind of works until it doesn't. There's times it doesn't work, and those are pretty painful. But you got to put, I was in Ireland one summer with my family, and we have all these Irish cousins. And we get together for this dinner at this Uncle Tim Harrington's house. Is that his name? I forget. But we were having lunch or dinner, and it's a whole bunch of us. And then my mother goes, "Oh, Greg's a comedian. Greg, why don't you tell some jokes?" And everybody's like, "Yeah, yeah." I'm like, no. I'm like, "No, it doesn't really work like this." This was a lot of years ago. And I was like, "No, it does not work like this at all." I'm like, no, everybody, oh, come on, dude. So I stand up and I start doing stand-up comedy and bombing. Meanwhile, you're in Ireland where everybody's funny. Like all my relatives are innately funnier than I'll ever be as a trained stand-up comic. And the rest of the night, I just sat in the corner alone like, "Mom, you fucked me on this one." When else did I bomb? Oh, when I bombed once, I gave a toast. Well, it wasn't a toast. I was hired at a wedding once. It wasn't a friend. It was like, it was this Jewish couple. And the husband was like 78. And the wife was like 35. And so I got hired by the groom's daughter. The groom's daughter hires me to do stand-up comedy at the Waldorf Astoria. It's the nicest hotel in New York. And they've got this gigantic ballroom, and it's like, you know, tablecloths and chandeliers and like bouquets of roses on every table. It's like expensive. And so, tablecloths. Yeah. That's how white trash I am. Like, yeah, tablecloths are a big deal. So everybody's sitting there and they're having drinks. They sit down and then they bring me up. And the daughter says to me, now everybody thinks it's really funny that like he's older than her and he's in on the joke. And, you know, just so tease him for being older than her. I said, okay, no problem. I got it. And this was like a week before. So I wrote a bunch of jokes about an older husband and a younger wife. And I go up and I'm talking about how, you know, he's marrying her so that she'll empty his bedpan. And, you know, he's talking about getting the inheritance. And nobody is laughing, especially not the bride and groom. But you know who is laughing? The daughter. You know, the one who's not getting the inheritance because of this young bride. And I realized the whole thing was a setup. She was paying me $5,000 to come in and just take a shit on her father and this young bride who's, you know, half her age. So that went poorly. And when else? I don't know. I think my father's funeral, I didn't do well. I was too distraught. It was a surprise death. He was 53. No one expected it. We were not speaking at the time. It was very difficult for me to process. So I wrote a poem for my dad for his funeral. And I wrote it the night before at like 3 a.m. And then, you know, the mass was in the morning and I read it. And I look back on that poem now and I think that's bad poetry. It was really heavy-handed symbolism. It was bad. And I cringe when I think about that. I should have just said a few words, but I didn't know what to say. Because I think a lot of his friends knew I stopped talking to him for a little while. And anyway, that's a whole other podcast. You guys have been down this with me before. Gibbs gave a great speech at my wedding. He got up and we had 200 people at the wedding and Gibbs stands up and he goes, and there was a lot of funny comedians there. There was like Dave Attell was there and I think Kevin Brennan. And the old Kevin Brennan. And by that, I mean when he was younger. Who else was there? I think Louis was there. I think Eddie Brill was there. Tom Cotter, Al Ducharme. Anyway, he gets up in front of a bunch of friendly people. And the first thing he says is, I met Greg in college. And like all of you, I couldn't stand when I first met him. That was the premise. And he just teed off on what a cocky, obnoxious, young drunk I was. And he killed. He killed. That was nice. Anyway, let's get into it. What are we doing? This is a long intro. It's too long. Am I even recording this? 18 minutes. Jesus Christ. All right. As I said, Hamilton, Ontario, Wednesday night. Toronto, Thursday night. Pittsburgh, the 28th and 20th through 30th of March. Boston, Laugh Boston, April 4th and 5th. Let's sell it out. Huntington, California, May 4th. Escondido, May 9th and 10th. Then I'm coming to Dayton, Kentucky, which I think is near Cincinnati, in May. Also Tampa in June. Torrance, Austin, La Jolla. Also, we got some merch. We got the new Sunday Papers mugs, T-shirts, hats, all at fitzdog.com. Get some of that stuff. And now my guest. She's amazing. She has won Emmys and Golden Globes. She writes for Hacks right now. She writes for Curb Your Enthusiasm right now. She wrote for Seinfeld. She is the character that Elaine from Seinfeld is based on. She did Letterman 25 times. She's done it all. And she's just such a sweetheart and such a, just, I have so much respect for her. So please welcome my talk I had last week with Carol Leifer. Hello.
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 Did you ever do the Meisner technique in acting where
No.
you're supposed to repeat each other?
No.
It's all about listening and paying attention. So when I say hello,
right,
you say hello back, but you're reflecting how I said it to you, not mimicking it,
right,
reacting naturally to the to my energy.
Yes.
So if I said hello,
I'd say hello.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or I'd say, I saw you 5 minutes ago. Why are you saying hello again?
Yeah, we just, yeah, it, Brando did it, De Niro.
Really?
Yeah, they all went to the neighborhood playhouse.
Oh,
it was
the
Sanford Meisner School. Oh. Yeah. So, and you're a New Yorker, so.
Is that thing in here? And it's like, did I finish this already? There's nothing in here.
Can we get a bottle of water? Miss Leifer, oh, there you go.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wait, so you went, did you go to college in New York?
Yeah, I went to SUNY Binghamton.
Oh, my nephew just graduated from there. It's the Harvard of the SUNY schools.
It is. I don't even think I could get in now.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I transferred to Queens College for my senior year because that's when I chose to become a comedian and stay in the...
Didn't Seinfeld go to Queens College also?
Yeah, he graduated from Queens.
And my old friend Jerry Red Wilson, I don't know if you ever heard of that guy, he went to Queens College.
Jerry Red Wilson.
He had a sitcom for a little bit, but the reason I bring him up is that it ties directly into your book, How to Write a Funny Speech for a Wedding, Bar Mitzvah, Graduation, and Every Other Event You Didn't Want to Go to
in the first place.
Yes. I read it. I loved it.
Thank you.
I mean, I do this for a living, and I still glean some stuff in there about how to be concise.
Yep. Yep.
Know where you are.
Mm-hmm.
Know what time it is.
Yes.
Know. Well, you also say, don't say, here's, all right, can I start with
my
problem with the book?
Yeah. Well, all right.
You list things that you shouldn't say, and it's very funny. You have like a couple of pages of jokes of bad ideas and what to say. I would do every one of those.
Well, of course, because you're a professional comedian.
Yeah.
You know how to work a crowd. What I say to people is every comedian is a speech giver. Every night when you do a set, it is essentially a sort of speech.
Right.
So you know what you're doing. But this book was written... really, because I've gone to so many events, as my writing partner has, Rick Mitchell, Emmy-winning Rick Mitchell, comedian as well. And people, it's painful, the speeches that they give. And, you know, we felt like this is short, handy. It's 15-something on Amazon right now. Come on, that's two lattes, maybe.
And you'll laugh.
You'll learn. Right. And we soup to nuts, beginning, middle, end.
Yep.
Jokes to use should you need a joke from two professional comedy writers. Take them. We have templates for lazy people. If you're really afraid of giving a speech, we give you like a Mad Libs. Just fill in the blank here.
Yeah.
Here.
I would suggest to people.
Yeah.
If you're getting married and you're worried about your best man or your maid of honor, buy this book and send it to them.
Yes.
Maybe even fill out the template for them.
That's a really
good
idea.
I'll take this book a step further, and I want to work on this with you as the next project, and I'm not kidding. I already had this idea before the book, but I think it's a good extension of the book.
Okay.
We set up when I die, I want things done a certain way. I know I want Van Morrison Into the Mystic playing. I know that I want... there's a series of wedding photos of me and my wife that I want laid out in order throughout the wedding.
Okay.
I got a guest list. I got people I don't want showing up.
Mm-hmm.
Not only do I know who I want to speak at the funeral, I know which stories I want them to tell.
Ah, perfect. And I bet you have an order of the people that you want them to speak.
Mike Gibbons closes.
That's right. That's easy.
So I think it's a website. I think you pay like... $1 or $2 a month to maintain it would be all this information. You would upload your photos.
Yep.
You would upload your music.
Right.
You would upload your guest list, and you would have the stories written out. And then you could even have comedians come in and punch it up if you're not funny.
That is a very good idea.
Right?
Yes. I have to leave now to go put it together.
I wish you'd committed I like when a comedian goes all the way out the door. Yeah.
I really should have.
Yeah.
I didn't want people to see my galoshes.
Oh, right. Did you expect more rain today?
I did. Oh, I overprepared.
I was thinking when you got here how I have gratitude for this podcast. Because if I didn't have this podcast, I never would have met you.
That's true.
I think you reached out to me the first time we made contact.
I wouldn't be surprised.
And then we marched the picket line together.
Yes.
We went to lunch.
We went to John O'Groats together.
What a place.
Yeah. The homemade biscuits.
Oh, my God.
We got to go again.
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, and put this website together. Okay.
Yeah.
It's a date.
So anyway, I'm grateful that you're here.
Thank you.
Yeah. So the book is also something that you're going to make money from, and this is going to charity?
Of course. Every penny will be going to the Carol Leifer Fund.
Take the D off the fund.
Yeah. Look, I got a kid who's going to college.
I know. Is he a senior this year?
He's a senior.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's all happening.
Yeah, that's an interesting time. And then you're looking at empty nest for...
Yeah.
How long were you and your wife together, living together before you had your son?
I would say probably 2002 we started living together. Yeah.
So about 3 years, and then you became parents, and now you're going to be alone in the house.
Yes. But getting married was a good idea because the best thing about it was that now I get to call her the wife. You know, yatata, the old wife. And then I didn't even realize straight guys, they have the perfect excuse all the time for getting out of anything. It's like, hey, you want to go to Vegas?
Yeah,
I can't. Yeah. The wife. Yeah.
Right.
So I got into that club. Which is
so
good.
You're both playing that card. It's a double win.
Yeah, that's true. I guess. I haven't been privy to her saying it, but I bet she does.
Right.
But then I also share with straight males the feeling of 8 o'clock on a Saturday night, already very late for an engagement with friends or a show.
Yeah.
Pacing by the door. Saying very loudly, come on, let's go. You know, it's like, what's happening in there? Does she have another face that she bought?
Right. It is amazing. And it's like, it's the people that are late are consistently late. I'm late sometimes because something happened.
Right.
But when you get a friend that is always 15 minutes late, you go, why are you not making this adjustment after 50 years of life?
I know. I will say a lot of women, namely my wife, runs very late.
You're right. Yeah. But what about for work?
Does she
show up late to her job?
No. She is not working right now. She's on a lot of boards and that sort of thing, does important work that way. But she's pretty prompt. I'm much prompter.
Yes, you strike me as a very prompt person.
I am.
You're a pro. You're the kind of person that I feel like, well, you know, you talk about how you dated Jerry Seinfeld. Obviously, you were the inspiration for Elaine, but that you watched his work ethic.
Mm-hmm.
And you learned early on that being a comedian is not just because you're funny. It's because you're doing the writing.
It's the work.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I remember coming up in the old days when we were coming up in clubs.
What year was this?
It's like 77, okay. 78, 79.
Wow.
Because he was the MC who put me through the audition night.
Catch a Rising Star?
Comic strip. Yeah. And, you know the life of comedians. We fuck around all day.
Yeah.
First of all, we go to sleep at like 3.
Uh-huh.
You get up at noon. Then you fuck around. And Jerry would always be at some point going, all right, I need to head back to my apartment. Why? I need to write.
Yeah,
and he
really?
Would write at least an hour every day.
Uh-huh.
With the yellow pad, the big pen. And, you know, never once didn't do it.
Yeah. I remember him saying once, you know, a comedian's never going to amount to anything when they go on the road with golf clubs. I don't fully agree with that, but I respect the work. So did you try to do it that way? Did you get the yellow pads and try to sort of do it exactly the same as him?
No, I was a very typical comic that way. But my writing style, and I'm interested to hear about yours, is more something will come to me and I'll write it down in the moment. I don't really make a concerted effort to do it. Or I'll get an idea about something, then I'll sit down and start to do it. But he really just, it's the blank page, and he really starts from nothing. And
then
he comes up with something.
Well, you say something in the book that I'd heard before, and I swear by, which is tell yourself you're going to do it for 15 minutes.
Right.
And you will write longer. But if you don't, that's fine.
Yeah.
You always write longer.
Yeah. And if you tell somebody to do something for 15 minutes, it doesn't sound horrible.
Yeah.
It's like, okay. And especially because people do not want to write a speech.
Yeah.
They just dread it. Yeah. And dread it. And if you say, all right, I'm going to give it 15 minutes, there's not really anybody who starts doing that and then says, you know, after 15 minutes, all right, that's it. A lot of times it's like you have your speech done.
Yes.
In 15 minutes.
Yes.
Because it's really not that hard to put together.
Well, also, I think writing is a lot of germinating. I do think that we, like you're talking about your kid writing a term paper.
Yeah.
And they're putting it off and they're putting it off. Guess what? They're doing it in their head.
Yeah.
But you need that time where you're subconsciously getting the ideas together. And then that's why it comes out so fast in the 11th hour.
Yeah.
But my writing process is my notepad in my phone.
Oh, okay.
I'll just like, if I have an idea during the day,
I'll
tell you what my most recent ideas are for jokes. I'll just write down like a sentence.
Okay.
And then I will try to sit down and write a few beats. Then I take it very raw on stage.
Oh, not that worked out.
Record it. No, riff on it. Record
it. Yeah.
Then I listen to that because I just know that if my adrenaline's not up, my creativity is not at its peak.
Mm-hmm.
And I need to be at the kitchen table like I was when I was 12, trying to make my parents laugh.
Yes.
And feeling the pressure to make them laugh. And I put myself back in that situation, and it all just comes. Married for 25 years, people ask, what's the secret? As if like we won't tell it, like we don't want to share because we're competitive or something.
Yeah.
And these people that write books about it are traitors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Like, oh no, that's privileged information. It's like the Manhattan Project. No, nobody can know. Yeah.
I don't know about the bomb analogy, but otherwise that works. I need to track down the guy that hacked my computer so I can find out what my passwords are.
I like
that's
that.
That's cute, right?
Yeah.
I'm trying to think, though, is it better if I say it about my mother? Like, my mother got hacked.
Yeah.
I want to find the hacker so she can finally know what her passwords are.
Because older people are worse with passwords.
Mm.
I don't know. I think it's better with you because everybody doesn't know their passwords.
Right.
And has trouble with it.
Right.
So, yeah, I would say that.
Okay.
I have a joke I could ask your opinion
Yes, on. Please.
Okay. I do a lot about plastic surgery and how much I hate looking at it. And the joke is, I saw a woman walking around Beverly Hills, and I wanted to ask her, did you go to a board-certified surgeon or a puppet maker? So, what do you like?
Yeah, I like it. I like it.
Or a marionette maker.
No, I like the puppet maker because then you can do a little tag about Geppetto. I don't know what the line is, but something about, is it Dr. Geppetto?
I like that. That's good.
Yeah, she's walking and I'm looking for the strings. How is she walking without the strings?
That's great.
Yeah.
I'm taking that.
That's funny.
All right, puppet.
I like that.
Puppet more than marionette.
I gave her a glass of water just to see if she could drink it and talk at the same time. Now, speaking of which, you look amazing, which I said to you before the show. Have you ever had any work done? Botox, filler?
No, I just...
Are you serious?
Yeah. Keep it natural.
Damn.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
That's pretty amazing.
Well...
I mean, not that you're that old, but you are older than me. I look like I was in a microwave.
No, you don't, Greg.
Look at my neck.
No. No.
Your voice just went 3 octaves higher.
No, no. No, you look great. Because the way, here's how I look at it. I've seen so many people, especially here in LA, with work as opposed to sticking with gravity.
Yeah.
And gravity is okay.
Sure.
It's okay. It's just people are afraid of it. And then they start doing, I know a woman who's 25. Who got a brow lift.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I was like, why? And she's like, I look tired.
Mm.
It's like, take a nap, bitch.
Yeah. You look tired. Now you look surprised. Yeah, I mean, I talk to a lot of young women now that have gotten Botox and things because they want... I mean, have you seen the before after picture on... Who's the one that's dating Timothée Chalamet now?
Oh.
It's one of the
Kylie Jenner.
Kylie Jenner.
Yes.
Have you seen the before after picture on Kylie Jenner?
Well, you mean from way back? Because she had
from when she was like 18, pre-work.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean.
She looks like a different person.
It's a completely different. Yes. And you know what? There was nothing wrong with her before.
I know. Yeah, no, those Kardashians, it's a full-time person at the house.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just whoever, which sister's next? Come on. Gotta go. Gotta move. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if I could have gone back in time and my hair, which is starting to thin out, if I had caught it when it first started, they have hair plugs now. Look at every rock star that's on tour from the 60s. Mm. These guys all have full heads of hair and they look amazing. And I did spend a lot, and I wish I could go back and either go to enough therapy where I could accept myself no matter what I look like or get some goddamn plugs.
I don't know. The plugs, I think a lot of people, a lot of women appreciate when guys... are bald or, you know, losing their hair, and they just go with it. It's like a confidence thing.
Yeah, that's true.
Because, you know, that's another thing that can go really bad.
Uh-huh.
Like in, especially years ago with the bad hair plugs, you know?
Yeah.
Joy Behar and I used to call it Doll's Head Revisited.
Because it's just rose. Yeah. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. Joe Rogan got him, and then he shaved his head, and now he's got a line across the back of his head because, you know, they take the follicles out of a line underneath the hair that will always be there.
Yeah.
But he shaved that, so now he's got this scar across the back of his head.
Oh.
And he shaves his head so he doesn't even...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. With men, to me, it's not about the hair.
What's it about?
It's about the face.
Yeah. It's about the eyes.
The eyes.
Right.
Are important.
You know what's hard is eye contact for some people.
Mm-hmm.
And for some people, they're looking down. For me, my family, we're known for maniacal eye contact.
Really?
Yeah. And people get a little bit off put.
Huh.
By how hard we look into people's eyes.
And that was part of the family.
My brother has it. My mother has it. My brother has it a lot.
Wow.
Yeah.
Where it's creepy or... See, I think eye contact is good. And younger people don't know how to do it anymore.
Right.
Yeah.
My daughter has it.
Oh, that's good.
I've talked to her about it. She's like, Dad, how do you know when to look away? I really don't know. I consciously look away sometimes so that it's not too intense. But my inclination is to just stay laser beamed into the eyes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Eye contact is a good thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's funny though about when you're talking about your family. I just heard Amy Poehler on a podcast and she was It was a very interesting observation. She said, like, when you're growing up, your family is kind of like its own country with its own rules. And then you leave your family to go out into the world and you see other things going, that's not how we did things. That kind of stuff.
Right.
Interesting.
Right. Yeah. It is definitely something you pick up, obviously.
Yeah.
I mean, literally, your first human interaction is when you're breastfeeding and your mother is looking in your eyes as you breastfeed.
Right.
And then as you get older, how you get socialized, how much they look away. I mean, definitely social media. If you grow up watching a parent on their phone, you are going to get on your phone a lot.
Right, right. And the other thing that I don't, you know, my son is a senior. I don't think his generation understands is like, if I have a conflict with someone and it's gotten to texting and, you know, it's not looking good, I make sure that I get together with them to work it out.
Right.
Because you can't from here. It's like you get together with someone, it changes the whole dynamic. And especially if you come in with an attitude like, I really want to work this out because we're not in a good place. Younger people are afraid of like talking on the phone to somebody.
Right.
Which, you know, I love. I don't like catching up by text. It's like, let's take 10 minutes and talk to the phone.
I have phone friends and I have text friends.
Yeah.
Like my friend Matt Malloy, I will call.
Oh, the actor, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's good.
He's bald and he made a very good living as a bald actor.
Hmm.
He and I have very, and Paul, who owns the joint, he knows Matt very well. He's the kind of guy, when he answers the phone or I answer the phone, since we're both 100% Irish, here's how I'll do it. I'm going to do it for you.
Okay.
So you can see how we answer the phone every time. Hopefully this gets picked up by the
Is it hello? Hello.
Now you'll hear it. This is the Irish phone answer. And he always answers my calls.
Really?
I'm saying that now, so it... All right, so I'll just have to tell you. So when he answers the phone, we go, hey, deedly, deedly, hally, hee. And then he says it back, hey, deedly, deedly, dee. And we will go back and forth for sometimes 5 minutes.
Really?
And everybody in our house just walks in the other room.
That is hilarious.
And then he got this dog who freaks out because it's a high pitch, dee, deedly, dee. And the dog starts barking and going crazy. So he can't do it when his dog is around.
Oh, that is so funny. See, I'll have to do that now with my Jewish friends, you know, say on the phone,
that's good.
I'm going to do that.
Do you feel a kinship with Jewish people more than you do with, like, because I do with Irish people?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's reverse racism. It's a race that I just like more.
Yes. Yeah. No, you definitely feel a kinship. There'll be certain things that you experienced growing up in a Jewish household.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What would you say is the best thing to be culled from growing up in a Jewish household?
Using coupons whenever necessary. I think because Jews, you know, we come from a long line of comedians,
right?
Comedy, you know, in the old days, it was pretty much most of the tribe.
Yep.
Were comedians.
You mean starting in the U.S. or before that?
I think in the U.S.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Cliff Nesteroff has a great book about how Jews started comedy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He's on CNN a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. I would think that. But also, you know, if I'm with someone Jewish, it's not unusual. I don't feel as awkward saying, waiter, you know, I have found, I did ask for no tomatoes, and I see that kind of stuff.
Will you not do that in front of a goy, but do it in front of a fellow Jew?
I have to feel it out.
Yeah, I have to feel it out.
Yeah, but...
But if you're with Larry David, there's going to be a lot of sending back. There's going to be a lot of customizing the order.
Yeah, and that's all fine.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, ask a Jewish person How are you? Here's something you'll never hear. Can't complain.
It's like that old joke about the waiter comes over to four Jewish women and he says, is anything all right?
Yes.
But here, what I married a Jew. So what I love about the Jewish culture is there's a raw honesty to it. There's dialogue that I feel like there's not the feeling, like I'm Catholic and I think there's sort of like an impetus to conform to what's already been said, to fit in, to be a part of it. It's tribal,
right?
To fit in with the tribe. And I feel like with Jews, it's a dialectic and it's challenging. And do you agree with that?
Yeah. Like, give me an example of what you're...
Like, I mean, on a base level, yeah. Like, what restaurant should we go to?
Uh-huh.
And an Irish person will go, well, let's go to Murphy's Pub. And everybody go, yay, great, we go to Murphy's Pub. And
yeah.
The Jews will go, you know, the pasta there is dry. What do you think about?
Yes.
And there's a lot of debating.
Right.
But I think on a higher level, I think that I've talked to my wife's father was a communist. And we would talk deep into, he was a guy who nobody agreed with. And he represented this far left. And
this is not Julius Rosenberg, is this?
No.
Okay.
No, Joel Covell. He was very famous. He published a lot of
really?
Books. He had a chair at Bard College. He taught sociology or socialism at Bard College.
Mm.
And really intelligent guy. And so I had these amazing talks with him because it's so refreshing to talk to somebody who's impervious to being judged about their belief system.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very powerful.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you know, now that you are talking about it, that I think about it, another thing about being Jewish is also like in my family and I think in the culture, you know, like my mother would always say, you don't ask, you don't get, you know, so it's also about asserting yourself, you know, but, you know, I've talked about this before, you have to be careful with asserting yourself, you know, the squeaky wheel gets grease, but you know, you don't want to be a pain in the ass. It's like making the balance.
Right.
But advocating for yourself seems to me to be a good Jewish attribute.
Yeah, I think it shows confidence. I think as a father of a daughter, that's something we really try to instill is like,
raise your kids Jewish or Catholic?
No, kind of. Actually, my daughter sort of like fell under the spell of Catholicism through my mother a little bit. Not that she like practices it, but she's kind of like taken by all the mysticism. Like, you know, we took her to Cathedral St. John the Divine in New York and they have this whole thing about the ascension and Jesus ascending and whole thing about the transfiguration of the wine into blood. And, you know, for little kids, that really kind of captured your imagination.
Yeah, it's very,
so
Harry
every
Potter.
Time. So every time we go to church, my mom would take her to church all the time and she would sit and she was about 9 years old and she sat there. We walked in and she lit a candle. She got on her knees and she sat there for 10 minutes like this, head down.
Wow.
Praying. And she got up and I go, what were you praying for? And she said, your father, who she never met. She never met my father.
Wow.
I was like, wow. Yeah.
That's intense. And
yeah.
Really good way.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
But getting back to it, like I just wanted to raise her to feel that she could assert herself.
Yeah, yeah.
In relationships.
Right.
You know, advocate for herself in school, you know. So, yeah, she's going to play. I'm doing a St. Patrick's Day show at the Improv. And she's going to write. I've done it every year for like 15 years.
Oh, wow.
And we're going to start the show off with me, my friend, and her playing some Irish songs together.
Oh, no.
And she's going to play guitar, and then she's really good at the flute.
Wow.
California Dreamin'.
Ah, cool.
Yeah.
I used to play the flute.
Did you?
Yes, when I dated men.
Was it phallic? Is that what you're saying?
No, I played flute in my grade school band and then my high school band. I was first flute.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Damn.
Yeah, all county band.
That's amazing.
So I admire other flautists.
When's the last time you picked it up?
Oh, God. A long time ago.
Still have it?
No.
How?
No. but it was a Gemeinhardt. I don't know if they still make flutes.
No, a Gemeinhardt. Well, and did you ever play like in a folk band or a rock band with it? No,
mm-mm.
Just school.
Yeah.
Marching?
No, I don't know how. I love marching bands.
Yeah.
Mostly because I'm stupefied that like you can play and march. Like good, where you stay in step at the same time. That blows me away.
Right, right.
But I'm also blown away that, you know, ice hockey players can skate backwards.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
No, ice hockey is kind of mind, as somebody who's grown up, I still play ice hockey.
Oh.
The coordination of moving on your feet in a different way than you've been raised to do.
Yes.
Having a stick that you have to be looking at the puck and out of the corner of your eye, you're looking out for a 180-pound guy who's going to level you.
Right.
And looking
and
for
look
other...
at the ice, right?
Looking at the ice. You're looking for the other players to pass to. You have to, you know, eye-hand coordination. You have to stand in front of the net. And when a 90-mile-an-hour puck comes, you have to be able to tip it to move directions.
Mm-hmm.
It's really... I think it's the most involved sport.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing when you watch it.
Yeah. What was your sport growing up?
Field hockey.
Nice.
Yeah. And then I was surprised that I became a lesbian.
Did you ever own a Subaru?
Not yet.
Not yet?
Nope.
All right. So you're not there yet. You're still slowly coming out of the closet after 20 years.
But I did love the field hockey. That was a fun game too.
Oh, it was great.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. My sister played that. We used to go watch her play. But not in college.
No, SUNY Binghamton did not have a, I don't think they had at the time any sports teams. I don't know.
Well, you can't go outside during the school year in Binghamton. All right. I want to ask you about, you're working on hacks now. Like over the years, you had a lot of nominations for Emmys from multiple shows.
Yes.
Never won one.
No.
So all the industry used to talk about is when's Leifer going to get the gold?
It was the talk of the industry.
Yes. Variety magazine would comment on it. And then now you're working on Hacks and you won an Emmy.
I won an Emmy.
And a Golden Globe.
Yes.
I mean, what a morality tale, right?
Know,
just
I
keep
know.
Working.
Yes. After 40 years of writing.
Unbelievable.
I finally won an Emmy. And a couple of people have been like, really? Was it that important to you? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
It was very, very important to me.
Yeah.
And then the Golden Globe. I didn't realize when Hacks won the Golden Globe, like the writer producers get one too. So it's coming tomorrow to the house.
Really?
They deliver it to your house.
Nice.
Yeah.
Wow. That's got to feel good.
Really. It does.
And had you gone to the award ceremonies for all the times you were nominated?
Yeah.
And didn't
win? I'll always go. You nominate me? Go get the dress, get the hair and makeup.
Yep.
Put me in a limo and I'm there.
Yep.
Yeah. But,
And what was the mood like after you wouldn't win? Would it get to you?
It kind of bugged me during Seinfeld because we always lost to Frasier.
Frasier always won.
Frasier
that's right.
Always won. So that was disappointing.
I feel like Frasier was an actor's show and Seinfeld was a writer's show.
Yeah. I felt that too, of course. But no, we didn't win. But this year, what was funny was Hacks was nominated, and I was offered to write for the show.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, you know what? The Bear was supposed to win.
As a comedy. Yeah.
I know. But they had really kind of won a string of awards up to then.
Yeah.
So I was like, you know what? I'll take the gig writing the Emmys because I don't want to sit there and lose.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote on it. It was fun. And then right before the award, the stage manager comes over to you in the, you know, backstage and says, you know, you need to come with me because if you win the Emmy, you're going to walk out from this side instead of the audience. And I was like, okay. So it's like, you know, and then they said Hacks. And I was blown away. And I just got to walk out.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah. So the only bummer was I was wearing, you know, my sneakers backstage and wasn't really all that glammed up. But
who gave the acceptance speech?
One of the three showrunners. Mm-hmm. I think it might have been Paul Downs.
Yeah. Paul Downs.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
So Is that show, do they improvise the lines at all? That seems like it's pretty tightly scripted.
Well, the interesting thing about Hacks is the writers, it's written all on Zoom. And then once the shows and the scripts are done, the showrunners go off and shoot it. So I haven't been there when they've shot it.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Have you met the actors?
Yeah, I've met the actors.
Hannah Fassbinder, is that her name?
No, Hannah Einbinder.
Einbinder.
Yes.
Right,
Lorraine
right.
Newman's daughter.
Right, right, right. She's yeah. fantastic.
Yeah, no, I've met them and seen them at many Hacks social events, but we're not there.
But never in production.
Yeah, which is crazy because when I worked on Curb Your Enthusiasm, it was the opposite. Like, just when you start shooting, they would bring me in yeah. to be on set wherever we were.
Right, right. Wow.
Yeah.
That's fun.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I feel like Curb is a show that, I mean, there's not like a room like there was with Seinfeld with a process, right? It's just more like I've heard that writers send in just log lines, like a series of log lines, and then Larry will look at those and maybe pick one.
Maybe some people pitch that way, but going back to what we were talking about earlier, Greg, when I would want to pitch to Curb,
yeah,
I would reach out to Larry and say, can I come into the office and pitch?
Oh.
Because, as you know, pitching to someone is much better than something written
right.
on the page.
Right.
And you can kind of elaborate on it or get
you
a
can
feeling.
See what they're reacting
yes.
to and
yeah.
embellish on that.
Yeah.
Right.
But I knew the first time I pitched my stories to Larry, I was nervous, of course, as anyone would be.
Yeah.
But I knew this first one he would like, which he did, which was, and you'll totally relate to this, you know, as a comedian, don't you hate when you're with regular people and you tell a joke or say something funny and one of them goes, ba-dum-bum.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you want to strangle
yeah, yeah.
them. And he loved that.
Uh-huh.
He's like, oh, yeah, yeah. So we used it in
yeah.
the show, but
uh-huh.
that relaxed me because it was like, I had a good, strong feeling he was going to take to that.
Did you guys start out in the 70s together?
Larry was before me, but he was the MC at Catch a Rising Star.
Oh, okay.
When I went on my open mic night, and he put me through.
Why would he be an MC? He's the least warm human being in the world.
I never thought about that. That's so true.
I mean, was he a good MC?
Yeah, yeah. You know why it was good for him, Greg? Because, you know, Larry, what people don't know about Larry David, the comedian, is that if you went on after him at the Improv, if his spot was 8:20 and yours was 8:40, normally a comedian would get there, make sure be there 8:35. You had to be there at 8:20 because you never knew when it was going to walk off.
That's what I heard,
off.
Right,
yeah,
right.
Just, if somebody didn't laugh, he'd be like, oh, all right, none of you laughing, forget it, and he'd just walk off. You know, it was that kind of thing. But I think what was good about him emceeing was he could do a couple of bits.
And then
yeah,
pick and roll.
Right.
Right.
So he didn't have the pressure of, you know, a 20-minute set.
It's so funny how, you know, people can start out and stand up and gravitate to different, like, obviously you went in the writing direction eventually after a lot of stand-up. I mean,
yes.
The thing is, like, I was a Letterman fanatic as a kid. I started watching when I was, like, 10 years old. And I saw, I don't know how many times you did Letterman, but I...
25.
I saw you at least a dozen times. I mean, it was like you were, it was like Bill Hicks a little bit, or I guess a little after that. He was probably like 90, late 80s, early 90s. But did that become something that they didn't do a lot of pre-producing with? Did you kind of say, I have a set? And then just come on.
What was amazing about Letterman was he recommended me to The Tonight Show after the New York Laugh-Off.
Uh-huh.
You know, that contest.
Yeah.
It was on Showtime, and I got a call from Jim McCauley, who is the talent booker on The Tonight Show. He said, oh, David Letterman saw you and recommended you.
Yeah.
And I sent a tape to The Tonight Show, and they passed.
Uh-huh.
And then when Letterman got a show... he put me on. I was on within 2 months of the show.
Really?
But literally after that, Greg, he was like, you have an open door here. Whenever you have a set ready, come on.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. never had a...
You never vetted it? But
I only had to do it whenever I did the Letterman show. I would be in my dressing room and the censor would come in and you'd have to do it for, you know, of course, running your set to the person who's just sitting there like...
Oh, just as you're getting ready to go out.
Yeah. And like, okay, that brand name, you can't do that. Other than that, you're good to go. You know, that was it. But anytime I wanted, I'd just call them and set a date. So he was so instrumental and kind in developing my stand-up career.
Wow, that's really cool.
Yeah.
And did that have an effect on road work for you, or were you not somebody who did a lot of road work?
I did do a lot of road work, and it helped me a lot in getting gigs, but I don't know if I've ever told you this story. Have you talked to your audience about what the comedy condo was?
Oh, I mean, not enough. It can't be dealt with enough.
Well, to refresh your audience's memory, club owners, not the most on board, above board people in the world, figured out that instead of putting up comedians at a local hotel, I can buy a shitty condo and put the comedians up in that.
Yeah.
Get to write it off, blah, blah, blah. So I started doing...
And the housekeeper was the waitress.
Yeah.
It was never a pro.
That,
right.
It was a sty.
Yeah.
So I got to a point where I'm like, I don't know if I can do this comedy condo thing anymore. It's just disgusting. So I did a gig with Sue Kolinsky.
Oh, sure.
At this comedy club. I think it was in Phoenix. And we knew we were going to comedy condo, but we were together. So at least I had a buddy with me. And we get to the condo and the guy's there already. And he's like, hey, and hey. And he's like, you know, there's a pool out here if you guys, you know. Okay, great. We hung out. And it was like 7 o'clock and we got ready to go over to the show. So Sue and I are at the door. And we yell up to the guy, hey, we're ready to go to the club now if you want to come with us. And he comes down and he goes, I'm not a comic. I just live here. These sleazy club owners just gave the room.
He was ahead of the Airbnb. Yeah.
To one of their friends.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah. And that trip, I forgot to pack my rape whistle.
Yes. By the way, you know, here's another joke is in my notepad that I just started, is my grandfather was an inventor. Mm-hmm. He sucked. He invented the first rape whistle, but it sounded like this. Did not sell.
That's a great joke. You're doing joke, that, right?
I just started doing it last week, yeah.
Yeah, and it's killing.
It's killing, yes.
Because you don't see it coming.
Well, I'm nervous about saying the word rape in a joke. Sometimes people just really pull back and you're not going to get a laugh.
Right.
But
see, you know that as a professional comedian.
Yeah.
When someone is writing a speech, a normal person, this book is chock full of things you need to know.
Thanks to know and thanks to not. The best is what not to do. Hold on. I got to read a couple of these.
Yeah. Well, did we talk about the first thing that people, 101 that most people don't do, is that when you get up to give a speech, you need to tell the audience who you are to the person being celebrated.
Yes.
You know, do people get up there and they start talking and like 2 or 3 minutes in, you're like, who is this person?
It, you know, right.
It becomes like an episode of Murder, She Wrote. Like who, what?
Yeah. All right, here's things not to say at a funeral.
Okay.
And again, I'd say all of them, but I'm a pro.
You are.
Okay. I mean, he was in his 80s. I'm fucking opening with that at my mother's funeral. Everybody would fall down laughing. That's so great. Margaret, I'm sorry for your loss. But since you're single now... Her hair and makeup never looked this good when she was alive. All right, who's ready to put the fun in funeral? I mean, literally, I would open with any of those.
You should, right. But any jackass getting up there who's also a few drinks in.
Yeah, that's the other advice you give. Do not drink before giving a speech.
Right.
But the other thing that I, because I get asked to do speeches all the time.
Of course.
And the number one thing I do, which is in this book, is canvas friends and relatives for stories, because they've all got one gold nugget of a story.
Yes.
And as long as you give them credit, which they'll be happy for,
right,
now you got a great piece of material.
Exactly.
So I remember my friend Dave Hallinan died, and we were poker buddies. You know, we played poker together for 15 years, and you know, and we went on hikes together and whatever, but he wasn't like my best friend. And then his wife asked me the day before to give the speech.
Yeah.
And I'm like, fuck. So I got stories from his son, from his friends, and Carol, it's the best set I've ever had in my life.
Really?
Because when they're at a funeral,
yes,
they want to laugh bad.
They do. That's another misconception.
Yep.
And we talk about that, putting in funny stories, because it's celebrating the person.
Right.
You know, you want to enjoy their memory as opposed to being sad and depressed.
Yeah.
Like, my cousin died prematurely at 55 of cancer, and I spoke at his memorial. And, you know, it's also good, besides testing your speech out on someone who knows them, you know, if you have something that you're not sure to say, you can also check, you know, directly with someone. Like, my cousin Jay was, like, the biggest partier. He self-made. He had a yacht. We'd go on these vacations. He's just, I called him the Pied Piper of fun. Because he just, whatever, we'd do this
right,
and that. And what I wanted to say at his memorial was, he's the person who partied the hardest of anyone I know, and especially of someone who's in recovery.
Yeah.
Which he was.
Yeah.
But I asked his widow, can I say that about being in recovery? And she said, oh, absolutely. Oh, people, they know that about him. You know, so if you're a little worried about something, you can always ask somebody.
Yeah. And the best funeral, Irish wakes are famous.
Right.
So Jerry Red Wilson, who's the guy that I told you about, he died very prematurely. He was probably 36.
Oh, what happened?
Spinal meningitis. Oh. Yeah, it was really weird. He got it like that. They thought it was an ear infection. And if it's undiagnosed, it's like within 48 hours, you're in a coma.
No.
So anyway, so he dies. And the father asked me, we went to the, he was from Queens. We went to the funeral and we went to this Irish restaurant in Queens. And the father says to me, would you mind getting up and saying a few words? And I said, yeah, but do you mind if I bring up some other, because there was a bunch of comedians at the funeral.
Yeah.
And so I got up and I just did my best. He was a dear friend, so I had some really good stories. And he was a Pied Piper as well.
Yeah.
He was the fun guy. And those are the deaths that really hurt, you know. Because those people, you really, you don't get a lot of those.
And you miss them. So
bad. Yeah, right. Kevin Meaney, I miss every day. He was one of my best friends.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so I get up and I kill. And then I bring up Greg Giraldo. I bring up Dave Attell. I bring up Jim Brewer. I bring up Colin Quinn.
Wow.
And it goes on for an hour and a half. And everybody's dying. And the father says to me afterwards, he goes, we need to do this every year.
Mm.
And so we did it at Caroline's a year later, and we did it as a benefit for spinal meningitis.
Wow.
After 2 years at Caroline's, we moved it to Town Hall, which is 1,500 seats.
Yeah.
And we would get, you know, all the biggest comics would come out and do it. And it, we did it for 10 years.
Oh,
and we raised
God.
Hundreds of thousands of dollars for
That's
meningitis.
Amazing.
And his whole family would be there every year, his friends. We'd have a big after party.
That's so great.
Yeah.
Well, you see, that must have been a great show because you had all professional comedians telling these stories. I mean, a big reason why we wanted to write this book is also to console people. Like, the bar is set very low for a person who's not in show business to give a speech. No one's expecting you to get up there and Jerry Seinfeld, you know? So that should take a lot of the pressure off to begin with, that it's not going to be like that event that you had where one after another, it's a laugh riot, you know? So,
and also what you say is you kind of can't lose if you're sincere.
Yes.
If the comedy comes from, you know, like you said, celebrating your friend being fun, or if it's something that, you know, at the end of the day, it's not a stand-up set. So if you have moments that are sweet with no punchline, that only makes the joke that comes next even better.
Yes. And we talk about, too, the ending of a speech should always be heartfelt.
Yes.
You don't want to, you know, at the end, you want to speak from the heart.
Yeah.
About how you felt about this person. And even another 101 thing that we talk about in the book is, you know, how awkward is it when someone gives this great speech and they do a toast, which you should do, and then they just wander back to their seat, like go over to the person that you're celebrating.
Yeah, right.
Shake their hand, give them a hug, a kiss.
Yeah.
It's just weird. And they just exit stage left.
Go over to the buffet table.
Yeah.
You know who gave the worst speech I've ever seen was Gary Shandling.
Really?
It was Kevin Nealon's maybe 60th birthday.
Yeah.
And Shandling showed up, and they were very dear friends.
Yes.
And Shandling is one of my all-time idols, just one of the funniest, most unique. He was sitting at a table in the corner, and the speeches were later in the party, and he wasn't talking to anybody, and he's scribbling. He's coming up with stuff.
Yeah.
And he ends up trying to talk about the driveway coming up to the country club where the party was, and it was very... it had nothing to do with Kevin. It was just like a stand-up set.
Wow, I'm very surprised.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because he's, you know, was so funny and a thoughtful person.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing that people do now that's a big mistake is they go to AI to write their speech.
Oh, God.
Yeah, and that is a big mistake because we did it with the book. We took... a friend of mine asked me to help her write a speech for her daughter's wedding. So I didn't know her daughter at all, but I sat down with the mom and we got some funny stories and little tidbits about her and that, like bullet points about her daughter. We gave it to AI. It was such a nightmare.
Yeah.
What it came up with, like facts that are wrong.
Uh-huh.
Like if somebody told this speech at her wedding, it would have been a disaster. So we also... talk about how, you know, writing speeches, the personal stories are the gold.
Yes.
And especially because you're maybe the only one who has that story mm-hmm. about this person. So that's what you need to share with the audience because people love that. And AI's never going to have that because it doesn't have a heart.
It doesn't have a heart.
Greg.
Yeah. I have a heart.
Are you taking that in?
I'm thinking about my heart. I'm thinking about how much stand-up is about heart because I have depression. And when I go to a gig, sometimes I get it. It comes down
really?
Like a heavy blanket on top of me and I can't. And so there's times where I'm sitting in a hotel room in the dark. The show is in 2 hours and yeah. I'm going, how am I going to get myself on stage?
Really?
And then I go on stage and... because of the nature of the sport, you must be vulnerable. You can't go up there,
yeah.
shut down, or the audience is shut down, and
yes.
you never can. So every time I go on stage when I'm depressed, I find some way to just rip myself open. And not that I'm up there talking about my childhood traumas. It doesn't matter what I'm talking about. It still has to feel like I'm present in this moment and I'm connecting to you people.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I do that, I walk off stage and the cloud is gone. It's
yes.
miraculous.
Yes. I have sort of the same thing, a lot of dread sometimes, mm-hmm. and I don't know how I'm going to do this in this club and what I'm getting paid and, you know, the whole yeah. litany of things. And then you get out there and it's like, hey,
yeah.
how's everybody doing? And then, yeah, it does.
Right.
There's something in our DNA that performing does that.
Well, that's why I don't think I could ever stop because I think it's built into my... mental health. I
uh-huh.
need this burst of dopamine and acceptance and
yes.
creativity that's being affirmed by laughter,
mm-hmm,
you know?
Mm-hmm.
How much stand-up are you doing these days?
I've been doing a lot lately.
Really?
Because I wanted to write. My act was getting a little, I always call it like performing Oklahoma every night. I'll start with this, and then there's a bright Holden Hayes. So I started to write new stuff, and as you know, when you write new stuff and it starts working, you are re-energized.
Yes.
And so I've been doing sets at the Comedy and Magic Club on Saturdays because, you know, they do that 10 comics for 10 minutes each.
Okay.
And you do two shows. And it reminds me of the old days in New York when I would do like six sets mm-hmm. on a Saturday night. And to go up and do an entirely new 10 minutes and it works.
Yeah.
It's just like... Nirvana.
Yeah.
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 So I've been great. Doing a lot.
That's amazing. Yeah. Great.
Yeah. It's nice.
All right. It's time for Fastballs with Fitz.
Okay.
Is that a triple take you just gave me?
I think I did.
Oh, my God. What's a project that you regret?
Oh, let's see. There have been so many along the way. What's a project that I regret?
Does it rhyme with the generous?
Well...
And I wasn't loading that. No, I know. That's not why I was asking that. No, I ask everybody this question.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I know you and I have both worked for her, so.
Right.
Yeah.
It was not the easiest time. Mm-hmm. You know, I co-created her sitcom with Mitch Hurwitz.
Right. The yeah. great Mitch Hurwitz.
Yes. This so funny, incredibly funny Mitch Hurwitz. I don't regret it, though.
Uh-huh.
Just because, you know. Ellen is a very talented person.
Yes, she is.
Yeah. I mean, mega talented.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to be around talented people, however, whatever their makeup is. And we had great writers on the show. So, you know, and the writer's room, to me, it's a big reason I went into writing as opposed to taking the stand-up route. I love being in a being with other funny people is... So my jam. I love it so much. I'm now with the funniest person from every high school, you know?
Yes.
And that synergy and that combination is just...
Well, what's amazing is, like, I've been on shows that are tough, that have talent that's difficult.
Yeah.
And a lot of times that's when the writers get the closest because mm-hmm. you really have to bond and
bunker
commiserate.
Mentality,
yes. Mm-hmm. And sometimes an easy show, you kind of go like, okay. I want to bring up Johnny Mack is a guy who you write with a lot. John Max.
Yes.
He's.
I just worked with him on the Oscars.
Yeah, I noticed he was like the only person that you acknowledged in your book.
Oh.
That was very sweet.
Yeah.
I wrote on an award show with him one time.
Oh,
and
yeah?
He, yeah, he really stuck with me as just like this guy who's just like a utility infielder. He can do anything.
Yeah. And he's great. When I had jokes that I wasn't sure, you know, marionette or puppet, yeah. that kind of thing. He is very laser focused on jokes and joke writing and what's good and what to maybe throw out. He's a good editor.
Just so people know, like, he's probably the most prolific award show writer in history. He
yes.
writes for the Emmys, the Oscars, the Grammys, probably the Tonys. I wrote with him on iHeartRadio
yeah.
Awards. He writes for every award
everything.
Show. And he's got three going at one time sometimes.
Yeah. And he worked with Gibby on the Globes.
Oh, right. The
yeah.
Golden Globes.
Yeah, he came in. He's not only he's a double threat because he's not only a great writer, he's got, you know, the comedy, but he's an amazing manager. He can mm-hmm. juggle an incredible amount of shows all at the same time. And he's really good with people, and especially the Oscars, all this info is coming at you, and he can just juggle it so professionally.
I remember he was writing on that show and two others, and then he was getting on a jet for the weekend to help Mariah Carey do a roast in Orlando or something crazy.
Yeah, yeah. He is that utility player.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right. There's two types of people in this world. Go.
Only two?
Yeah.
Oh. It's pretty simple.
Mm.
Nice people. Not nice people.
Mm.
Yeah.
What do you think causes that?
Well, I feel like not nice people, and I see it a lot on the internet.
Yeah.
Comments and stuff. People who are unhappy with themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And, just take out their anger on other people.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
This world of, call them incel, call them whatever, but it's mostly angry young white men, and of which I'm one, so I don't want to knock them too much. But they're mad at the world, and they're feeling like they have a voice when they critique things.
Exactly. Yeah. And when I see some things that people write, I mean, it really, I can never picture myself wanting to hurt someone like that. I don't know. I'm not Mother Teresa, but it's like I was raised to like, just be a nice person.
I think that would be a really interesting docu-series, maybe even a series, is you track down some of these really vitriolic haters and you just interview them. Just find out, what is your life? What caused this? Do you know the effect? Like, let them meet, you know, Alec Baldwin and let them have a conversation with the guy that they just hated on and see how they feel about.
Right.
That's a good show. We should do that.
Yeah. It's a little like Catfish.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
But yeah, I just always look at those kind of comments and like, I mean, you know, did your mother raise you?
Yeah. Like right. Is this book out yet?
Oh, it's out.
Okay.
And I'm wondering, available.
But are you not getting any hate mail about this book? I'm sure.
Not. I don't want to say not yet because clickety clack.
Yeah. Clickety clack.
Oh, and today on Amazon, it's $15.
No.
Come on. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
See, now, great. Now we lost my whole audience because they're all at Amazon now. Thanks.
That's good.
It's.
They're watching the podcast and at the same time, clickety-clack, ordering on Amazon. Click. $15. Great book. Great gift.
All right, final question from Fastballs with Fitz, and then I'll let you go.
I hope I wasn't too Pollyanna on that last one, but I don't know.
Do you want to do it again?
No.
All right. What's the hackiest bit you've ever done?
Oh, God. I have to think.
I mean, 25 Lettermans, that's a lot of material. There must be one joke in there that you look back and you watch the set and you go.
I don't know. I love all my jokes.
Now that's Pollyanna. I love all my jokes.
Or
I'm going to make a t-shirt for you.
Pollyanna or incredibly narcissistic. I love all my jokes. Can I do a joke that didn't work enough?
Yes.
I always loved.
Yes.
Okay, but I have to stand up.
Oh, great. Aren't you
going to finally see my galoshes? All right, which camera do I do?
All right, stand back here and play to that center camera right there.
That's the center camera right there. Okay.
Wait, stand back a little further. Can you bend your knees? There you go. We got it. Okay, go ahead.
It's going to hurt the bit a little bit.
All right.
All right.
All right, he fixed it.
Okay, this is my impression. You got to go back to Archie Comics.
Okay.
Okay, my impression of Veronica walking away mad.
I don't get it.
Veronica, you know, she was Archie's, he liked her. She
yeah.
Liked the kind of, and that's how she looked in the comics.
She was always like that?
Yeah.
Show me Superman flying away mad.
You're done.
Show me Jesus mad. He must have been mad. Yeah.
Anything else?
Oh, that was great. Worth being the camera. All right, Carol Leifer's book, How to Write a Funny Speech for a Wedding, Bar Mitzvah, Graduation, and Every Other Event You Didn't Want to Go to in the First Place
great
is on
gift.
All
Get
internet
it.
Streaming. I loved it. Carol, I love you. Thank you so much for being here.
I love you, Greg.
All right.
Let's have serious eye contact.
Hey.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business and sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/redcircle.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.